Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
If you've got a Bible with you, and I hope you do, I'll be turning to 2 Samuel chapter 15. 2 Samuel chapter 15. For those of you that are visiting with us, we are doing a series on 2 Samuel in support of our Bible Bowl program for our young people and for our not as young people who are helping out with that program. They are for Bible Bowl this year. The topic is 2 Samuel, and so we have been working our way through the book of 2 Samuel. And as a reminder to everybody, when Samuel was one book on two scrolls. It was too long to fit on one papyrus scroll, and so it was divided into two scrolls, and that's why today we have 1 and 2 Samuel. So there is no true division between these two books, and so frequently we've gone back and looked at things that happened in 1 Samuel. And I hope that this study, that you're finding it beneficial, especially those of you going through the Bible Bowl program. I say this almost every week, but at 5 o'clock on Sundays we have our practice, which is we take the young people and they go against the adults. And I imagine if you ask any of the adults, they would say that they're getting a greater understanding of 2 Samuel than they've ever had. And these sermons are maybe a little different than your traditional sermons in that they're more surveys of the text rather than kind of prepackaged, pretty sermons with a bow on top. But I will tell you personally, this is the deepest dive I have done on 2 Samuel since I was in college. When I was in college, I was blessed to take 1 and 2 Samuel as a semester, for a full semester, with Dr. Rodney Cloud, who not only has a PhD in Hebrew, is also a professor of archaeology, has contributed to 5 different translations of the Bible. He is also fanatical about the life of David. And I was, 4 years ago, was able to travel to Israel with Dr. Cloud. And one of the highlights of that trip was as we went to places that were part of the life of David, listening to him tell the story of David in those places, like En-Gedi, or like En-Gedi where David had hid out from Saul in the caves and cut off a part of Saul's cloak, or in the Valley of Elah where David struck down Goliath, and hearing him tell the story of David and Goliath while standing in the field where David cast the stone from the sling. It was a highlight of that trip for me. And so it's been a blessing to me to go back and do another like super deep dive on 2 Samuel. And so I hope that it has been beneficial to you. This morning we're going to look at chapters 15 and 16, excuse me, which is what practice is going to cover tonight or at 5 o'clock. And in these chapters, which we're going to be able to say this for the rest of the time, we're still in dealing with the aftermath of David's sin with Bathsheba and Uriah back in chapter 11. That forever changed the course of David's life. David will, as I said at the time, will deal with the consequences of that sin for the remainder of his life. God forgives him. God forgives him immediately when David asks for forgiveness. But that doesn't mean that there aren't consequences to deal with. And that's a reality of life, right? I mean, we have to live with our actions. Even if we're forgiven, we have to live with our actions. This morning in class, if you weren't in class, Eddie Ray gave our prayer before class started, and I appreciate all the men who participate in our worship, and I appreciated Eddie Ray's prayer this morning. And in that prayer, he alluded to something that Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 4, where Paul said, "I have, fought the good fight, I have finished the race. There's now laid up for me a crown of righteousness," and Eddie Ray prayed that we would be able to finish the race, that we would, if we were faithful, we would receive the crown. And I was thinking after that prayer, part of finishing the race is enduring trials. And sometimes the trials that we endure are of our own making. And you see that with David. And there's a lesson in that. I mean, we're not going to live perfect lives. We're not. No one ever has except for Jesus. And we're going to have to deal with the consequences of that imperfection. One of the things I think we can take from that I hope you can take away this morning, I'm going to give you one thing. Okay, I say all the time that when you're covering narrative sections of Scripture. And by that I mean when you're just reading an account of what happened historically. It's very different than studying one of the letters of the New Testament, you know, where Paul or Peter or John was writing to a church or a group of churches and giving them specific instructions. In those letters, it's a lot easier to say, hey, I can take that and apply that to my life because he's writing to Christians existing within the church. But when you're reading a historical account of what happened in the lives of people who were attempting to follow God, it's a little harder to say, how do I apply the actions of this king who ruled an entire nation? You know, and how do I take that and apply that to my life? Here's the one takeaway I hope you'll have this morning, okay? And this was the thing that really jumped out at me, and it's something that has jumped out at me a lot through this revisiting the story of David, is that David defers to the will of God. Now, it looked different pre-Bathsheba and Uriah than it does post-Bathsheba and Uriah, but David, even though he committed that great sin, even though he's dealing with the consequences, he still, and we will see this pop up a couple of times in chapters 15 and 16, is deferring to the will of God. And so much, I think we can describe what faith in God is to a large degree as deferring to the will of God. Is that, you know, our human nature is that I'm going to follow my own will. I'm going to put the weight of my life on my own shoulders. And what faith in God is all about is saying, no, I'm not worthy of carrying the weight of my life. If I carry the weight of my own life, I'm going to fail and I'm going to spiritually die. And so the only way I can live forever, the only way I can live in glory is to recognize that there is this God who has a plan, who had a plan, who continues to have a plan. And the only way I can live with him forever is defer to his will. And so David is an example, even now living in the dire consequences of his sin, who continues to defer to the will of God. Now remember, after the sin with Bathsheba, he was told by Nathan the prophet, speaking for God, you're going to have consequences. And one of those consequences is the sword's never going to leave your family. And we saw that almost immediately last week when we looked at chapters 13 and 14, when you have Amnon, who took advantage of his sister Tamar, who was then killed by Absalom. Absalom, who then became a refugee, left Israel, eventually came back. He came back and he's in the city of Jerusalem. And we ended last week with David having not been willing to see Absalom for 2 years, finally agrees to see him, and Absalom bows before him and David kisses him, signifying he's forgiven him. But Absalom has some ulterior motives. And we see that coming to fruition in chapters 15 and 16, where we have Absalom, as Scripture describes it, executing a conspiracy. That word is actually in the text, conspiracy. Executing a conspiracy to take the throne from his father. And because of what he's trying to do, it causes David to abandon Jerusalem. Now, what was Jerusalem called after David conquered it? It was called the City of David, right? It causes David to abandon his own city. And so all of the points, and by the way, if you're visiting with us, if you got a bulletin, on the back page of the bulletin is an outline of this morning's lesson. And I've given you four blanks if you want to fill those in. All four of the words that go in those blanks will be the slides that we cover this morning. And so the first one of those things, and all those points, all those blanks have to do with the abandoning of Jerusalem. And the first thing we look at is the prompting. The prompting of the abandonment. What causes David to abandon Jerusalem? The city that's named after him, the city of David. Why does he abandon it? Well, we learn about that, the prompting of the abandoning, in the first 12 verses. Okay? Now, by the way, the first two words in the New King James Version and many other versions are the words after this. It's the same Hebrew that we see multiple times in the book of 2 Samuel, which usually indicates that this is like a section, okay? And Those two words are translated in other translations like the NIV, and I've got that, I think I have that in your bulletin, as in the course of time. And the reason why I point that out is that when you see the words after this, it may not mean that it's chronological. We've seen other examples where it clearly was not chronological in order. However, I believe that with chapters 15 and 16, most of what happens in these two chapters comes after Absalom's audience with David, where David kisses him. Now, it's possible that some of the activities of Absalom were going on before that, but I think most of what we're reading is happening after David forgives Absalom. Okay? And so that leads to, well, what prompts David to leave Jerusalem? Well, we read about that in the first 12 verses. And what prompts him is what Absalom is doing, and it appears as though David is somewhat unaware of the extent of what Absalom's been doing, even though he does it for a long time. Absalom is gaining allegiances within the city of Jerusalem, and not just within the city of Jerusalem, throughout Israel. How does he do it? He does it by becoming a politician. Okay, we're in election season right now, and you read about what Absalom is doing, and you go, that's what a politician does. He's acting like a politician, okay? I even put in your bulletin, it's like he's shaking hands and kissing babies, right? I mean, that's what he's doing. And he's offering up rhetoric. We hear that word a lot in politics, in election season. He's offering up rhetoric. Okay, what's the rhetoric sound like? Well, listen to what Scripture says. Let's go to chapter 15 and go down to verse 2. It says, Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit, many translations will say dispute, meaning that they are coming from outside Jerusalem to Jerusalem because they have a dispute with someone else, and they are coming for the king to be a judge in that situation. They're looking for resolution, okay? They're looking to be vindicated from their opponent, okay? And so he intercepts those who are coming to Jerusalem to have David be their arbitrator, to be their judge. He's intercepting them, okay? Anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision. Absalom would call to him and say, well, what city are you from? And he would say, well, your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel. So the indication is, though, that Absalom is, he's interacting with people from all over Israel, okay? All over Israel. And then it tells us, well, what does Absalom say to these people who have lawsuits, who have disputes? He says, look, your case is good and right. He's saying that to everybody? Yeah. You think everybody's case is good and right? No. But he's telling them, your case is good and right. But there is no deputy of the king to hear you. It's too bad there's no one here to listen to your plea. Okay? He says, moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice. He's a politician. He's a politician. He's telling everybody, if you just put me in power, that's what's implied, then you'd receive justice. Everything would be great. It would all be roses, right? He's politicking. He's shaking hands and he's kissing babies, and he's building up allegiances. Now, in verse 7, it tells us in the New King James, and I highlight this because our Bible Bowl is based on the New King James. Okay? It says in verse 7 in the New King James that he did this for 40 years. I put in the bulletin, it was unlikely. It's impossible. Okay? Many translations that you look at will say four. And the reason why is that there are some ancient manuscripts that say four, and there are some ancient manuscripts that say 40. Okay? Now, I don't know why the New King James and the New American Standard and others chose to put 40 in there instead of four, because 40 is impossible. How long did David reign over Judah and then Israel? For 40 years, right? And so if Absalom had been born on the first day that David started reigning, well, at the end of 40 years, David would be out of power, right? So this, the number just doesn't work. And so I don't understand why some chose 40 and others chose 4. By the way, tonight we're going to continue our series on Why Should I Believe? Talking about, can you really trust the Bible? And we're going to talk about the idea of manuscripts being created from the originals, copies being made, okay? So we're going to talk about these kinds of things starting tonight. But anyway, it's 4 years, okay? But if you're in Bible Bowl and you get asked the question, the answer is 40. Kyle, you got that? The answer is 40. But the real answer is 4. Okay, I was telling Mike before service today, I said, it reminds me of back when I was in the tech world. When I was in the tech world, one of the big things was to have Microsoft certifications, okay? And the more certifications you could have, the more, the more you could get credibility in the industry. And these Microsoft exams were really, really hard. You had to take these exams to get these certifications, and they were really hard. But we would always say, you can't answer the questions the way you would actually do it in the real world. You have to answer the questions the way Microsoft wants you to answer the questions. If you answer them the way you would really do it, you're going to get them wrong. Same thing's true here. If you answer the true answer, which is 4, you're going to get it wrong on the test. Does that make sense? Got it, Jill? Got it, Jill? Got it, Sarah? You got it? Okay. All right, we got through that. So, what's the outcome of all this politicking by Absalom? Okay, we'll go down to verse 6. All right, go up to verse 6. Okay, so I jumped down, I'm coming back. The outcome of this 4 years is Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel, which is what he was trying to do. Okay, it's what he was trying to do. All right, so Absalom has built these allegiances. He stole the heart of the men of Israel. And now he goes to David. Okay, now he goes to David and he says to David, let me go to Hebron to worship, to sacrifice, because I made a vow to God that if he let me come back to Jerusalem, I would live for him. Okay, now, by the way, ultimately Absalom does offer sacrifices in Hebron, but is that really the reason why he's asking for permission to do this? No. The real reason, and again, the text says, is a conspiracy. What he was trying to build up a force to come and take Jerusalem. Okay? He was trying to build a force to take Jerusalem. And so he leaves the city with 200 men. Now, the 200 men don't know why they're going with him. They don't yet know. But when he gets outside the city, he sends spies to all the tribes of Israel and says, when you hear my message, call out that Absalom reigns in Hebron. Okay? He's building an army. He's building an army. And he does one more thing. He calls for Ahithophel. And Ahithophel, by the way, folks, there's a lot of names in these two chapters. A lot. I'm not going to cover all of them. I'm going to cover a few of them. I'm going to hope to pronounce them correctly. But he calls for Ahithophel, who is one of the counselors to King David, and has him, and he joins Absalom. Now, that's an important point to remember, okay? So, all of this happens. And then we move into verse 13. And in verse 13, it says, a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Now, Absalom is outside the city with 200 men, and he has sent spies to every tribe, and he's gathering up an army. Okay? And David gets the message, Absalom's won the heart of the people. Absalom has gained power. And so apparently, to some degree, anyway, David is unaware of what's been going on. And so David gives the command, let's leave before Absalom comes and destroys Jerusalem. Let's leave. And what he begins to do is make preparations for the abandoning, the leaving of his city. And he does that by telling everyone to prepare to leave, except for 10 concubines that he leaves to take care of his house. He had talked earlier about having a house that had been made of cedar. He has a magnificent palace, and he leaves 10 concubines to care for the city. Now, those that leave with David, that prepare to leave with David, we have some names that come up from before. The Cherethites and the Pelethites. We read about them back in chapter 8 when we kind of listed David's, had a list of David's cabinet, if you will. Joab, his general, and on and on and on, the priests. And it mentions in chapter 8 that you had Benaniah, who was given control over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. That's back in chapter 8. Now, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, they were David's bodyguards. They were foreigners who had been brought in to be his bodyguards. So they all leave. And then there's a surprising group that leaves with David. And it mentions in the text, if you go down to verse 18, it says, all the servants passed before him, and there's the Cherethites and all the Pelethites. And then it says, all the Gittites, 600 men. Now, the name Gittite means that these are people from Gath. Gath is one of the major cities of the Philistines. We mentioned earlier about David killing Goliath. Goliath was from Gath. He was a Gittite. Okay? So these are Philistines. Up until David had conquered them, the Philistines were the mortal enemies of the Israelites, right? And now you have 600 Gittites, men from Gath, who follow David. And David says, well, I don't even know where I'm going. And you only got here. So apparently these Gittites had come into the city the day before, and they said, no, we're going to follow you. We're going to follow you. So you have the Cherethites, the Pelethites, the Gittites that all go with David. And David says, I don't know where I'm going. So at this point, apparently David doesn't have a plan as to where he's going to escape to. But for the next, I've got listed in the bulletin from verse 22 of chapter 15 all the way through verse 14 of chapter 16, we cover the pathway of the escape, the pathway of the abandonment. We basically follow David stop by stop by stop as he leaves Jerusalem. Okay? Now, all of these stops, and I should have put a map in here. I thought about it this morning. Why didn't I put a map? All these stops, he's going west. I'm sorry, he's going east. I got it flipped in my head. He's going east, okay? He's going east. He's going east toward, at this point, toward Jericho. And what I've got in the bulletin is I've got highlighted or bolded and underlined kind of three places that are mentioned as he leaves the city. The first one is the Brook Kidron, okay? The Brook Kidron pops up a number of times in Scripture. Sometimes it'll be referred to as the Valley of the Brook Kidron. What I wanted to show you is, this is a model. I show you this a lot. This is a model of the old city of Jerusalem that is in Jerusalem today in the Israel Museum. This is a model of the old city of Jerusalem from roughly the time of Jesus. This is first century Jerusalem. And so most of what I'm showing you on here was not there in the time of David. Pretty much everything from this point over is not there in the time of David. So I'm going to move to the left, which is the south, which is south of the Temple Mount, and show you this part, which is south. This right here, between these two sets of walls, was the footprint of Jerusalem during the time of David. Okay, and actually today, this area in the old city of Jerusalem is called the City of David. It's an archaeological park. So what's an archaeological park? It's like a zoo, except with archaeology. I mean, it's what it is. You walk in and you buy a ticket and you go in and they take you from archaeological spot to archaeological spot. It's like going to a zoo only with archaeology. Okay, and what it is it's within there is contained many excavations from back to the time of David, or even before the time of David, okay? But I showed you this to say that when we read about the Brook Kidron ran on the eastern side of the city of Jerusalem. And so you see this valley that goes down from the wall down. The Brook Kidron would have run in the bottom of that valley. And so you read about the people escaping and leaving over the Brook Kidron, it means that they are traveling to the east, okay? It means that they're traveling to the east. And so here's another view of again, what would have been the footprint of Jerusalem during the time of David. And so they are going out to the east, okay, in, over the Brook Kidron. And a couple of notes about as they go across the Brook Kidron. It mentions that Zadok, now Zadok is one of the high priests, and we read about Zadok being one of the high priests back in chapter 8, okay? And another of the high priests, Abiathar. Now, Abiathar is not listed as one of the high priests back in chapter 8. In chapter 8, it was listed as Ahimelech. Now, when I covered that, I said it couldn't possibly have been Ahimelech because Ahimelech was dead. And I said it was probably a scribal error that they had written down the name of the father rather than the son. Abiathar was the son of Ahimelech. And a few of you looked at me like, how dare you say that there was a scribal error? We're going to talk about that tonight also, by the way. The concept of scribal errors. Remember, there were no Xerox machines back at the time. So the way they made copies was they hand wrote the copies. Okay, Abiathar is the high priest, the son of Ahimelech. Abiathar, who was one who survived when Saul gave the command to kill all the priests, he was one that survived. And so we have the two priests, Zadok and Abiathar, and they come out of the city carrying the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant at this point was in a tent that David had built in the city of Jerusalem. We studied about that weeks ago. And they come out carrying the Ark of the Covenant over the Brook Kidron. And David says, no, go back. Go back. I want you to go back, and I want you to be listening and passing on to me everything that you hear, right? I want you to be listening for every, you know, and passing on to me. And that's where you heard the reading that Mike made this morning. That's where David makes this statement. Go with me down to verse 25. He's talking to Zadok. He says, the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. If, you hear that? If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. It says, if I find favor with God, he's going to bring me back. So take the ark back into the city, and if I find favor with God, he's going to bring me back. And then he says this, but if he says thus, I have no delight in you, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. What is David doing? He's deferring to the will of God. David knows he's living with the consequences of what he's done. And he says, let God do with me as he wills. Let him do with me as he wills. And that's why I pulled that out as our reading this morning, because it just, again, speaks to, even though David is in the midst of the tumult that he has caused, he's going back to saying, whatever God wills. Whatever God wills, that's what's going to happen. That's what's going to happen. And so he tells them, though, when you're back, you guys pass on to me the messages that you hear from Absalom, okay? And then he hears, as he's going on, David hears that Ahithophel has deserted him, and has gone to the camp of Absalom. And so David prays, Ahithophel was a counselor, he prays that his counsel will be foolishness to Absalom. He prays to God that his counsel will be foolishness to Absalom. And so David now, when he prays that, he's on the top of the Mount of Olives. Now, the model does not have the Mount of Olives, but the Mount of Olives would have been further off on the eastern side of Jerusalem. David, as he's climbing the Mount of Olives, it says that his head is covered. Sounds like it might be a test question. His head's covered, he's weeping, and he's barefoot. As he's climbing, a show of mourning, he's climbing Mount of Olives. He learns about Ahithophel. He prays that Ahithophel's counsel will be foolishness to Absalom. And he encounters another man, Hushai, the Archite. And he recruits Hushai to be his spy with Absalom. He sends him to go to Jerusalem to join with Absalom to be his spy. And here's where the dots begin to connect. He tells Hushai, I want you to win his favor. I want you to be on the inside. And then everything you hear, I want you to go tell Zadok. I want you to go tell the high priest. Well, he had already told the high priest, you send message to me whatever you hear. And now he's saying, Hushai, you tell everything you hear to the priest. You see how the dots are connecting? The dots are connected. And so he recruits him to be his spy. Okay? Then as he goes further up the mountain, he encounters somebody else that we've met before, whose name is Ziba. Anybody remember Ziba? Ziba, who was the servant of Saul and who becomes the servant of one of the hardest names to fingerspell in sign language, Mephibosheth. One night I was preaching at Bellevue, but I didn't even know my wife was here until I turned around and I saw her there. I was preaching at Bellevue, and you guys know that I go off in rabbit holes and side trails all the time. And we joke around that Mephibosheth is one of the hardest things to ad lib because it's such a long, complicated name. And I just went down this rabbit hole and I started saying Mephibosheth, and I said it like 8 times. And finally I looked at it, I was like, I'm so sorry I did that to you. If you don't know, my wife is a sign language interpreter at the Bellevue Church of Christ. So that was what the context was there. Anyway, Mephibosheth, Ziba is the servant of Saul, who's the servant of Mephibosheth. And Ziba, he encounters Ziba, and Ziba has a bunch of stuff. Okay, sounds like it could be test questions. Okay, he has a bunch of stuff. He has 2 donkeys, 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And just to summarize for time, David says, who is all this stuff for? And David's like, Ziba's like, it's for your household and all the people that are following you. Okay? And then he asks the question, where's Mephibosheth? Where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba says that Mephibosheth has decided to stay in Jerusalem. And here's the quote. Today, the house of Israel, this is what he says Mephibosheth has said. Today, the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. Now, his father was Jonathan. His grandfather was Saul. And what Ziba's saying is that Mephibosheth looks at this and says, hey, my family's house is going to come back into power. Well, Mephibosheth later, we'll study about this later, wholeheartedly rejects that he ever said that. And so it looks as though Ziba is kind of trying to play both sides, right? And so anyway, David believes Ziba, however, and he gives Ziba possession of all of Mephibosheth's, all that was Mephibosheth's, he gives to Ziba. And then we read about a village named Bahurim, which is a village on the way to Jericho. And he encounters another individual, and this one also from the house of Saul, named Shimei, son of Gera. And Shimei, when he encounters David and his followers, is cursing him and throwing stones at him. And a name that has popped up several times, Abishai, who is the brother of Joab. Abishai, along with the other mighty men, they want to cut off Shimei's head. Because cursing David, throwing stones at David, they want to cut off his head. And David, just to summarize, I know we're past time, to summarize, David, again, defers to the will of God. You know, saying, hey, maybe this is God's will. Maybe this is God's will. David defers to God. And they leave Shimei. They leave it. David, just like David had always before, spared Saul. Even though Saul would, by all appearances, have been his mortal enemy, he spared him time after time after time. Here, he won't let any of his men, his mighty men, lay a hand on Shimei. And he continues to curse and cast stones. And then the last thing that we read, which I have labeled the pollution of the city, the pollution after the abandoning, is that as all of this is happening on this pathway out of Jerusalem, Absalom is moving in. Absalom comes into Jerusalem, but he's unopposed, right? There's no battle because everybody has left the city except for 10 concubines and 2 high priests. That's all that's left. And so Absalom comes back into the city, and he comes back in with Ahithophel, who's the counselor who came from David. But he encounters this man, Hushai, who David has recruited to be his spy. And if you read it in detail, you'll read that he begins to interrogate Hushai. Why would you leave David's side? And Hushai says, well, whoever's going to be in power in Jerusalem, that's who I'm going to serve. Hushai is working to win favor because Hushai has been given a mission to be a spy for David in the house of Absalom. And then what does Ahithophel, who's the counselor, and you need all these names to keep track of, what does Ahithophel counsel Absalom that he should do? He should go in to his father's concubines. And he tells them to do that for two reasons. One is so that everybody will know that your father hates you. Because that's a sign of, you know, that you're taking his throne. Right? It's a sign that you're... Remember when... I'm going off on a side road. Remember when Abner went into one of Ishbosheth's concubines and how Ishbosheth, who was really like a puppet king of the north, how he took great offense at Abner doing that. And then when Abner went away, Ishbosheth was like, oh no, what have I done, right? But he was very upset because that is a sign of you're taking my position. Well, that's what Ahithophel is telling Absalom. You need to go do this because that's a sign. That's a sign that you're disconnected from your father. You're trying to take his throne. This is going to be a show of power. And it makes a statement here that the advice of Ahithophel is considered to be like the oracles of God. I mean, Absalom took the word of Ahithophel, as we might say today, as the gospel, right? I mean, took it like he was following exactly what Ahithophel said. And so we kind of leave ourselves hanging in the story at the end of chapter 16 that Absalom does what Ahithophel says. He goes into his father's concubine. So to be continued. But the thing, again, that I go back to, and I realize this has been a summary of a historical account of David leaving Jerusalem. But the thing that I take away is that David, in this great trial, which has come about because of what he did, he's still every step of the way going, let's leave it to God's will. And I think there's a great lesson in that for us. As we are trying to finish the race, as Andy Ray prayed this morning, as Paul told Timothy, as we're trying to finish the race, as we endure trials, even if they are trials of our own cause, that we caused because of something that we did, it's still critical to continue to defer to the will of God. That's what faith is all about. Taking the weight off of our own shoulders and deferring to the one who has the plan to save us all. That plan, though, involves a choice. We have a choice to follow or not follow. We have a choice. I do not believe that God made us to be robots who have no choice one way or the other. I believe that we have a choice. We have a choice to follow or not follow. We have a choice to defer to God or leave or rely on ourselves. But if you know that you need to defer to the will of God, you know that you need to choose His way, and you know that you want to live the rest of your life for Him, then why not begin that journey by making a decision that you're going to commit the rest of your life, that you're going to be baptized, to be buried into His death, to come out of that water like He was resurrected from that tomb. What a great day to begin that new life with a new master, a new covenant. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while Steve leads us in our invitation.